Clacy Andrew Rivers says he has an affinity for the trash animals, possums, raccoons, and skunks. And I think that's really all you need to know about him. I'm Dave Austin. With me is Dennis Meeks. And who are these people? Oh, and this is for you, Norm.
Say something.
Do you have the... Can you hear me?
Yeah, and I'm rolling.
Did you make sure that...
Oh, okay. Oh, shit. Oh, fuck. A lot of sci-fi ideas are becoming real now.
Yeah, it's like Barbarella's tongue box.
Yellow.
Yeah.
Yellow. It is therapeutic.
The last generation to be raised without the internet.
Yeah.
The first generation to jump into the internet. What does it mean? Like, did it really even happen?
How you doing,
Clacy? This is going to be successful.
Yes. Well, I haven't seen you in a while.
I'm looking pretty old. Look at this beard.
Yeah. Gray beard.
Yeah. I'm going to be Santa pretty soon.
Oh, well, then you can make some money during the holidays.
Yeah. Yeah. I like to shoplift. So. Sorry, the cats just flipped out when I said shoplift. So.
Uh-huh. So you shop, if you're dressed like Santa, you should be able to get away with murder.
Oh, God, yes, because, you have the big baggy clothes and you're Santa.
Yeah.
So who's ever going to question Santa?
They should totally make a movie about a bad Santa.
What a great idea.
You're like, you got your finger on the pulse of Hollywood, Dennis. You really
does,
do.
Man.
Did you ever write any scripts, Clacy?
Yep.
What'd you write?
I have this script called Death Park. It's about a world. It's a world creation where there is an amusement park just over the border in Ciudad Juarez, where the rides are designed to rarely but regularly kill riders.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so there's a whole ecosystem around there.
Uh-huh.
And basically to get people to come to Death Park. Okay, so I'll give you the backstory real quick.
Yeah.
So there was a drug kingpin. I don't know if you guys had heard of Carlos something or other that was – he was like a billionaire in cocaine. He was Mexican. This was in the early aughts. But he died in Mexico City getting his plastic surgery.
Okay, yeah.
And so I thought that was an excellent way to get out of the game because, drug kingpins – tend not to retire.
Right.
Anyway, I read that and I was thinking, man, that is very convenient. I wonder if he's down in Chile or someplace or in Europe living with his billions.
Yeah.
So that's what got me thinking about the idea. And so the idea was this guy with all these billions decides to get out of the drug business. And instead of, dying in plastic surgery, he actually says, hey, dudes, you can take over my business. Just don't, kill me and my family. I'm out.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes all of this money and he buys an old amusement park that had gained some notoriety in Ciudad Juarez for being kind of dangerous. And so that was the attraction. A bunch of the young kids would go and ride the rides and brag about how they survived the rickety roller coaster.
Because it's rickety, old, creepy with all the creepy carnies and everything. Yeah.
Right. Poorly upkept and all that stuff.
Right, yeah.
Well, he pours billions into it, and he creates this kind of Westworldy-like, place where basically kind of anything goes with permission.
Yeah.
And all of these rides are designed to, like I said, rarely but regularly kill you.
Right.
And the way they get people into the park is basically if you're a player, everything is comp to you as long as you're riding and getting a certain amount of points each day.
Ah, okay.
So it starts.
I love it. I love the concept already.
It starts on the Day of the Dead and it ends on the Day of the Dead. And the person who has the most points and survives gets, this huge, trillion peso prize or whatever. It's going to be something pretty ridiculous. And the way everybody plays is when you go on a ride, you have a card, a big kind of PIV type card.
Yeah.
And you scan into the ride and you get credit.
Uh-huh.
And some rides, you know, some rides are very dangerous. You know, they'll kill like, you know, once every few hours.
Okay.
Some rides will, you know, will kill like maybe once every few weeks.
Yeah.
And it's something like you're on the log ride and a random number comes up and the log goes underwater and never comes up.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Or you're riding the Bionic Nun, La Monje Bionica.
Yeah,
and
see?
That's a more dangerous one. And it's all like all the cars look like nuns, you know, with their habits swept back and everything.
Uh-huh.
And a bar just, you know, drops down for a split second and like beheads one car and then pops up again.
Okay. Now, do the people going to the park know that there's it, the rides are intended to kill?
Yes. And so okay. the way he makes money is there are cameras everywhere. There are camera crews everywhere. There's CCT everywhere.
Uh-huh.
And they basically beam this stuff all over the world for all of the, you know, all the folks that like that
yeah,
stuff.
Like Videodrome.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, for everybody who's into the gore and,
yeah.
you know,
snuff
the real
films.
Stuff,
yeah.
It's happening right there.
I love it.
And then you get a bunch of rubberneckers that come, you know, like a bunch of Euro trash and Americans because they're right across the border.
Yeah.
And they like to go because even if you're not riding the rides, it's a bit dangerous. And it's kind of a, you know, it's very much a bragging rights if you can go to Death Park and, you know, come back with a t-shirt and everything.
I love it.
So that's the world we're in. And that's the one that I thought it was going to get optioned, but it didn't. But I
keep
messing
around
with it. It'd be a
great B-movie. Yeah, can you share the script with me? I'd love to read it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I got to dig it up, but
dig it up,
I
man.
I haven't messed with it for. Okay, right on.
Hey, Dennis, how do you say something or other in Spanish?
Las cosas.
Las cosas. That means something or other.
No, it means the something.
Oh, okay. Because you said Carlos something or another, and I thought that'd be great. So he could be Carlos Cosas.
Cosas
Crew,
Say that is other.
Yeah, otras cosas, other things.
Okay, Carlos otras cosas.
Yeah. And so just real quick, I'll tell you kind of the interplay, and this is where it was a bit, you know, I mean, you know, it's a sophomore effort, if you will.
Yeah.
So I went to the trope of jail. And so basically what happens is you don't even enter in Death Park yet. It all starts with a dude that got arrested for vehicular manslaughter. He and his girlfriend were out and he wrecked the car and killed the girl. And the girl, of course, is tied into the town they're at, which I think I said it in Van Horn, a little bitty town outside of El Paso. Mm-hmm. And so the dude, he goes to jail. And while he's in jail, the kind of the mayor of Van Horn wants to kill him. You know, he wants revenge for killing his daughter. And so basically he sets it up. So he's going to be transported from like one jail to the other. I think I was moving him from like El Paso to Huntsville. And like, as soon as they get outside of the city, the two guards in the van that are transporting him, you know, they get him a big gulp and he has to pee and they won't pull over. Mm-hmm. And so they pull over in the desert and they're like, okay, well, you know, this is where we're going to stop. We can't stop in a city. And, you know, he knows what's going to happen. He knows that this is not normal.
Uh-huh.
And so that's where he makes his escape. And I got real B movie with the scene because, you know, one guard is in the van and the other guard is going to escort him out to pee and he takes off.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they fire some shotgun stuff and they're coming after him to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And of course he finds a rattlesnake, you know, right next to where he lands behind one of the sand dunes outside of El Paso.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's kind of one of the opening action scenes is this rattlesnake going end over end in the air and landing on the guard.
Uh-huh.
And the guard freaks out. And then the other guard tries to shoot the snake and shoots the first guard in the foot. And that's the way the guy gets away. So,
and then he ends up going to Death Park.
Yeah. So Death Park, Ciudad Juarez is right outside of El Paso, and that's why I kind of set things in El Paso. So yeah, he kind of escapes to the desert, and some rock climbers find him.
Of course,
Because
they're prone to do. Yeah,
they are. Well, there's a big rock formation that a bunch of like rock climbers love outside of there called Waco Tanks.
Okay.
And so that's where, you know, he found some people before he died in the desert. And nice. They're all going to Death Park to check it out. And that's
the rock climbers are going to go to Death Park well. Okay. Cause they're thrill seekers.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I love it, man. It's all coming together.
Right on. So this is my other sophomore effort is, of course, his love interest ends up being a prostitute because in Death Park, like I said, as long Anything as you're goes. Playing a certain, yeah. yeah, as long as you're playing a certain amount, prostitutes, food, everything is comp to you because they need an influx of these young men and some women to kind of churn the machine.
Right.
And of course, the prostitute that he hooks up with pretty quickly is the daughter of the original park owner who was brutally murdered by Carlos Cosés Otras or whatever.
Yeah. Love it.
So kind of B-movie-ish, but I really had fun with the kind of the setting. Yeah. So there's stuff that goes on. And then last thing real quick is that the penultimate event is there's this huge Ferris wheel and the park is all kind of like Euro Disney, pretty advanced because of all that money that got poured in and all the money they're making from selling the video. But the penultimate thing is this giant Ferris wheel that's all decorated like, you know, with the sugar skulls and everything comes off of its hinge once a season and rolls down the main part of the park, just, you know, killing everybody. Mm-hmm. And so that's my
like a huge death wheel. Yeah. Got it.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 And so that's kind of where it climaxes at is trying to assassinate Carlos Cosés Otras. Our hero is battling other players, you know, to win. And, you know, there's a lot of death that happens in the park just because anything kind
of
goes.
Right. Yeah. A lot of just ancillary madness and debauchery and death and everything right. kind of. Yeah, exactly. Right. I was talking about you with Jen. We were discussing you and I said something like that you were one of the most genuinely freaky people I knew. And she was like, how could you say that about your friend? And I was like, no, Clacy would take that as a compliment. I mean, for him, that would be like a real badge of honor. So I want to ask you, do you take that as a compliment? And do you think of yourself as a genuinely freaky person?
I am freaky adjacent. I'm always attracted to, you know, people that let their freak flag fly. I'm not brave enough to be a true freak, but I sure like the stories and I surround myself with, you know, people that are out there.
How does this relate to possums or opossums? How do you prefer to say it?
I say possums.
Okay, good. How does this relate to your fascination with possums?
So I guess one thing, so all of my life, I've always been kind of for the underdog. I grew up in a Mexican-American neighborhood as kind of a poor white kid. So I kind of dealt with quite a bit of bullying. And I used my sense of humor to get out of it. But, you know, I mean, when all your friends are kind of related and Mexican-Americans and have a culture, you know, there was always the risk of getting bullied or picked on and stuff. I've always been for the underdog. And I guess like the trash animals, possums, raccoons and skunks to me have always been sort of, you know, the underdogs, especially possums because they're kind of derpy and, you know, they only live like 3 years. And so it was funny because I just started kind of putting up possums because I thought, well, you know, I kind of dig them. You know, they're doing their own thing and they're always getting eaten by something or killed by something. Yeah. And then people started to respond and, you know, and then, you know, people are like, yeah, you know, maybe they are freaky tails, but they do eat a lot of ticks. Mm-hmm. My fascination with possums is that I am a fan of the three trash animals. Raccoons, possums, and skunks, and you know they're really kind of defenseless. You know, I mean, they don't move fast. They're not smart enough to get out of the cold. A lot of them lose their tails to frostbite.
I didn't know that.
And yet they abide. They're not hurting anybody. And I like the idea that I don't want to hurt something that's not going to hurt me. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so my fascination is I like the underdogs, and they are very much an underdog marsupial.
So I want to ask Clacy about this Mexican-American neighborhood he grew up in. Where was this?
It was called Sunnyside, and it was on the south side of Wichita Falls. So I grew up in Sunnyside, and I don't know if you guys knew Terry Siegler and Jeff White and Olivia White. Did you guys meet mm-hmm. them?
I don't think so.
I knew Olivia White pretty well.
Yeah. So Dennis knew. So I grew up in Sunnyside, which was, like I said, fairly Mexican-American. I would say probably about 70%. And then Sun Valley was across the highway, and that was kind of more mixed. And at the time, Sunnyside was, you know, it was definitely kind of, I'm not going to say lower class, working class. But it was, you know, well-kept and such. But it has since disintegrated. The last time I was in Wichita Falls, it was like every second house was vacant. And, you know, there's like pit bulls running free. And it just looks sort of like Beirut. But when I was there, it was kind of a, you know, it was a poor neighborhood, but it was kind of fun. You know, we had train tracks behind the neighborhood, and we had, you know, we had a little hamburger shop that was family run, and we had a little handy hut, which was the convenience store. And, you know, we'd play outside every day, you know. So there was, it was vibrant. Last time I went, I'm pretty sure it's kind of died out though.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, my dad was in the Air Force, and he did not want to live on base. And so he decided to buy, he was a enlisted airman, and my mom was a homemaker. So we couldn't afford much. So he bought in Sunnyside, and that's where I grew up.
And what are your feelings about Wichita Falls in general?
You know, so the city itself, I don't know. I mean, I've lived in a number of places, and kind of like Sean said, when you're poor, every place is the same. You know, because I was so, you know, he would go to these places. I'd be like, hey, what do you do? And he goes, well, I don't have any money to do anything. I just kind of hang out at home and drink beer and play cards. And I go, yeah, I guess so. So growing up there, I don't know. You know, it was kind of stressful. And on top of that, just to add to it, so I grew up in Sunnyside, and I was bused to Washington Elementary. And Washington had been the high school back in segregated days in Wichita Falls. And so Washington Elementary was mostly Black, Black and mm-hmm. Hispanic. But I would say, like, you know, 50% of the kids at Washington Elementary are Black, because it was smack in the middle of, you know, the east side of town, which was, you know, across the tracks where, mm-hmm. you know, they had Trout Street and the gardens and the projects and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so it was a fairly stressful childhood. Mm-hmm. I remember enjoying it, but I also, you know, every day something could pop off, and it generally didn't work out in my favor. So could pop off, you know. So mostly I just got to, I tried to be friendly to everybody. I kind of guarded myself with a, you know, I developed a fairly wicked sense of humor to kind right. of deflect without getting into a fight.
Mm-hmm.
And I made my way through. But and yeah, so Wichita Falls, I wouldn't go back there. The only thing that I think was kind of a crown jewel of Wichita Falls was actually Midwestern State University. Out of all the stuff in Wichita Falls, yeah, I mean, I've gone to MSU. I've gone to University of Texas. Went to nursing school at University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. Mm-hmm. And I went to Denton for, you know, a semester while I was killing time waiting to join the Army. Uh-huh. And some of the classes and some of the things that I was able to kind of get away with at MSU, looking back, it was a pretty good value, and it was a pretty good time.
Mm-hmm. Clacy was one of my, I don't know, I never spent the time with you, Clacy, that I did with David and Joel. But when you and I talked, it was always forthright and deep, and as David mentioned, sometimes freaky. I have great memories of some of that stuff.
Well, hey, you remember that we spent the night up on top of Atterbury?
I do. And so to make it worse, so David, do you remember what Atterbury is?
Yeah, the grain silos, is that right? The abandoned grain silos.
Yeah.
And so
I think we just said it as a joke at the table one day. We're going to go to the library tonight and spend the night. And so I show up and Clacy's like, let's do it. So, I mean, broken steps where if you fall, you would have fallen 200 feet to a concrete
side. Yeah.
Holes everywhere, pitch black. We climbed to the roof. And then Clacy takes me to this box on the roof that I didn't know was there, full of pigeons.
Yeah.
And we lie down and we just go to sleep. And then he wakes me up and Molly goes, hey, watch this. And he just picks up a pigeon. It doesn't fly away. He shows me the pigeon. Then like a peace offering to the universe, he lets the pigeon go. And then he lays back down and we go back to sleep. And in the morning, I'm not a morning person. I would have slept till noon. But Clacy's like, we got to go. I'm like, it's 6 in the morning. He goes, yep, let's go. Like, totally in control of the situation.
I was cold. I'll be honest. I probably would have slept in, but I got cold up there. And then the other thing is we were drinking up there because you went through, I think we all went through a period of imbibing, but you kind of took it to an extreme. And I think we were drinking up there. It wasn't the same time that you got alcohol poisoning, but it wasn't too far away from that time either.
Well, you have to understand. So this interview is about you, David. So when it gets to be about me, but you know, I grew up with around parents and elders that had drinking problems.
Okay.
And I worse than it could do. And so I became straight edge when I was, you know, 15. I had an X on my hand.
Right, right, right.
If one of my friends smoked or took drugs, I would hit them. I mean, I was pretty anti drugs and anything that would ruin your body. And finally, Joel and I went to New Orleans as our senior trip because our high school was one of the ones that didn't have a senior trip. And I decided that we're going to start drinking again. And it just kind of spiraled from there. But yeah, Clacy, you and I were on the top of Atterbury drinking Bacardi 151 out of the bottle. Can you tell me about your experience with the tarantula hawk in Sunnyside?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So every fall. It was either every spring or every fall, the tarantulas do this migration. The male tarantulas go looking for females. Females are stationary, but the males kind of got to go find a mate. And the males don't live that long. I think they live a few years. But the females can live, you know, 15 years. So they just kind of stay put, have babies, and the males go looking for them. So on the country roads, there's these tarantulas that I think it was like end of summer, near fall when they do their big migration.
And they just cover the roads. They're like all over the place.
Yeah. And so I would catch them. And then sometimes we'd sell them, you know, because people would buy them for like $5, you know, on a pet tarantula, not knowing that this was a male that was going to die in a year or two. My dad would drive me, and sometimes, you know, an older friend or whatever, you could take a paper shopping bag and you just put it kind of in front of the tarantula. And then you get behind it and scare it into the bag and you grab it. And they're pretty easy to catch. You know, because especially when they're on the road, they're easy to see. And so I had like a rabbit hutch with like 15 tarantulas in there. And I, you know, my big thing was to sell them to people for $5 each. And that was the way I was going to make money. And so in Texas, one of the things that eats tarantulas is this thing called a tarantula hawk. They're also called digger wasps, but I don't say digger wasps very often. I call them tarantula hawks now. So we had all these tarantulas out and we were out running around at night. And I was close to the cage and it was about dusk. And I felt this this big thing hit me. And I thought it was a cicada because, you know, those are really heavy. And so I go to swat it and it was one of those giant tarantula hawks. And it stung me like all down my neck before it flew off. And so, I was up close and personal with a tarantula hawk one night.
Aren't those extremely painful stings?
They are, man. I, for whatever reason, I have been stung by quite a few of like, they call it the Schmidt pain index. And this entomologist Schmidt went around getting stung and then describing it kind of poetically about the stings. And, one of the top rated ones were, I think, tarantula hawk, bullet ant, and then cicada killer. And I've never been stung by a cicada killer, but they really don't. You got to be trying to get stung by them. But when I was in the army in Panama, I got stung by a bullet ant. Those are those ants that, if you ever watch the documentaries where like the young men put on those woven things with a bunch of big giant ants like woven into it, and they've got to like prove their manhood by not taking their hand out of the woven bullet ant thing. I got stung by one of those and I felt like I had been shot. And that's the nickname in the army is bullet ants, because it feels like you've been shot for a while.
Jesus, where did it bite you?
It bit me on the thumb. And what had happened was we were in a one of those big Green Army trucks, they call it a 5-ton, and we were training at Fort Sherman in Panama. And, you know, it's rainforest, it's jungle. And so there's a lot of like trees that overhang, and the big 5-ton, you know, hit one of those overhangs. And I looked down, you know, because I felt something on my thumb. And next thing I know, man, you know, my whole arm went numb, and it was one of those damn bullet ants. And yeah, I it was painful for, I'd say, a solid like 12 hours. And that was when I was like, you know, pretty tough and in shape and young and all that. And
yeah,
it was rough.
You've got quite a record with pain, then, it sounds like.
Yeah. And I didn't really want that record, to be honest.
Clacy, do you mind just giving us kind of like a timeline of like your life, just so we can place all these things in order, like when you were born, where you're from, and then all the different places and stages in your life, if you can even remember it?
Sure. I was born in 1970 in Miami, Florida. And I moved to Wichita Falls, Texas in 1975 because my mom met Glenn, who was my adopted dad. He was in the Air Force, and he was stationed at Shepherd Air Force Base, which is a really big training base in the Air Force system. So that's why there's all those, you know, European pilots and lots of airmen running around Wichita Falls. So in 1975, we moved to Wichita Falls. I graduated high school in 1988, and I went to MSU, which was the small, it was a 4-year college. I was a chemistry major for the 2 years I was there. So I met you guys in 1988 when I was in the dorms. I was in for a year, the fall and the spring. And then that summer, I ended up, I went to live on a ranch outside of Wichita Falls in Henrietta, that Justin's family had since the late 1880s. Justin was my best friend in high school, and we've remained friends to this day. And the reason that I went to go live in his grandparents' ranch is because his grandma and his grandfather both got like brain cancer about the same time. And Justin's dad had died of cancer as well, fairly young. And they linked it back to they had used, I want to say in the 80s, they had used Agent Orange, like extra Agent Orange got repurposed to kill mesquite trees. And so because it was a ranch and they wanted more grassland, they used a lot of like this Agent Orange type thing to kill off mesquite trees so that, you know, they wouldn't be as dense. And that's what Justin thinks probably killed his dad and his grandparents. Anyway, they were sick. And so he asked me to go out there and just kind of mind the ranch. And my only job was it was a pretty big ranch. It was 200 and something acres. Over a week, I needed to kind of do the perimeter of the ranch just to see if any fences had gone down, like the barbed wire fences and some of the fences, because his uncle was raising cattle and they were Brangus. They were part Brahma and part Angus. And they raised breeder cattle. And then those cattle would be sold to help the stock, you know, the meat stock of other cattle. And so there were two herds of Brangus cattle. There was a bull with each herd, and they kind of avoided each other living on the ranch. And my whole job the year I was there was just to, if I saw that the fences had been down, was to tell Justin, and Justin would tell his uncle, and they would come in and repair the fences. So I lived on a ranch for a year while I was going to school. And then after that, I got my first apartment, me, Sean, Ethan, signed for it. And then shortly after that, Clell Tickle moved in. And then we even had John Gonzalez move in for a little while. So it was kind of like a, I don't know, it was kind of like Crash Central for a little while. And then after that, I got a wild hair and I decided to drop out of school and went to Miami. And this was like, gosh, 1991. And I stayed in Miami with my grandparents for a little while. And then when Justin and Maybe had gotten settled in Stuttgart, they invited me out. And so I went to Germany and I stayed with them for about 4 months.
Now, why were they months. Were they there because of the military also? Or
did yeah, they just, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So Justin had joined the army. He was in the reserves and he got activated for the first Gulf War in 91. And then once, you know, he had been deployed to the first Gulf War. And then his unit, I guess he got stationed in Germany, in Stuttgart, in the Kaserne over there. And then after they got settled, they invited me to come out for a while because they knew, you know, I was dying to travel. So I stayed with them for like 6 months. I saved up some money. I actually was able to find a job in Germany directing German movers onto the American bases. They wanted an American like manager. And I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. And I didn't really speak German, but, you know, they didn't really care because they got the job because I was there. So I was able to save up a little bit of money. And then I went hitchhiking in Western Europe. And right before I went hitchhiking, I figured I needed to do something for college money. And so many of my friends had joined the Army or Air Force or whatever. So it's just kind of natural. So I did delayed entry into the Army, and then I just started traveling around. I started hitchhiking and, you know, riding trains, that kind of stuff. Went through Germany up to Amsterdam, to Paris, through part of France. I didn't go to Spain, which is a big regret. From France, I went over to London, and then I headed to Scotland because my grandfather is a Campbell, and you know, we have Scottish on both sides of my family. And so then, yeah, I just kind of rode around, hitchhiked, traveled around Scotland until my money finally ran out. I had enough for my plane ride back and came back to the United States. And I had a few months to burn because I had done delayed entry until August, and I think I got back in like May. And so I went back to the old house and it was kind of depressing. And so I was like, you know, let me just go someplace else for a little while. I still had the travel bug. So I went to Denton and I took a couple classes, and that's when I saw Dennis and I saw you, David. And that's when I met Cinnamon, the woman I married.
And that was, I remember, what year was that?
So that was, let me see, 1992, okay. When I came back and I ended up marrying her and had some kids and then got divorced.
It's been so long. I just remember Cinnamon had, she lived in a house just around the corner from where I was living. And yeah, she really was an impressive looking person. I remember her walking around with her long legs and her cowboy boots, like wearing like cutoff shorts and cowboy boots, walking around. And she was really impressive. A statuesque person. I know it's been such a long time. I don't remember much about her other than you did marry her. And how long were you married?
So we lived together for about a year. She followed me up to she graduated from UNT with, I think, a degree in merchandising and marketing. And so she followed me up to, you know, we had the summer fling and I thought that was it, but she ended up following me up to Watertown, New York, to Fort Drum. And we lived together for about a year up there. And then we got married. So we got married in, 93, I think. Yeah, we must have been married like 93, November of 1993. So we were finally divorced in 2010.
That's a pretty long time. And you were in New York that whole time?
Oh, no. I'm sorry. Let me go back. So I was in, so we got married in Watertown, New York. And then I had only enlisted in the Army for like 2 years. It was a really good deal. I was going to get the Army College Fund. I figured I could do anything for 2 years. But, you know, I was married and Cinnamon got pregnant right before I was getting ready to get out. And so I reenlisted, and that's what, in the Army, when you reenlist, at the time they gave you a choice of, you could pick a school, an Army school, you could pick a post, or they would pay you to go to college for like 6 months. And I chose to go to LPN school, or licensed practical nurse school, where they basically trained me to be a LPN at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. And then I got stationed in, so about 1995, I reenlisted and I ended up shipping out to Walter Reed for training. And then when I was done, it was about a year of training. We got stationed at El Paso at Fort Bliss. And I was in El Paso from 1996 to 99. And that's when I got out and we moved to Austin in September of 1999. And I started going to UT. August. I got out in August and I was able to like squeak in as a computer science major the fall semester of 1999. And I lived in Austin from 1999 to 2005, graduated with my Bachelor's of Science in Radio, Television, Film. And I worked as a, I worked wherever I could, but mostly what I did was commercial editing, where I actually edited commercials. And I would do things like, I did a lot of pixelating. Like if you see a car commercial where, you know, it splashes snow up in one of those, like, you know, Lexus Christmas commercials. At the time, what I would do is, you know, they would have footage of the car and then we would put in all the snow in the background. And that kind of stuff. And so I would have these projects where I'd be paid well for like 3 months, but then I'd be out of work for a month. Or I'd have another project where I would do, I'd edit like a car commercial for the local market. And then once that was done, I'd be out of work again. I just wasn't finding enough work. And, you know, Cinnamon was like, if I see you in pajama bottoms one more day, I might kill you. So we moved to Houston. And she was a teacher, and while I was in Houston, I got back into nursing, and I was trying to dig up, like, you know, film stuff to do, but then I got a wild hair, and I decided that I was always a smart kid, and smart kids get graduate degrees, so I actually entered the part-time program law school at University of Houston Law Center. And so I have the most expensive participation degree ever. I got a law degree from University of Houston Law School, and I graduated law school 2008, right when the Great Recession really hit.
Yeah, the financial crisis, yep.
Yeah, and so that was a terrible time to try to be a new lawyer because a bunch of really experienced lawyers just got laid off and were in the job market. And at the same time, that was when, you know, the separation had happened and then we decided to get divorced. And that's when I was like, I panicked a bit and I entered a accelerated program because I already had a degree in radio, television, film. And I had a background as a nurse in the Army. So I was able to do a pretty intense like 3-semester course at the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston. And that's when I got my Bachelor's of Science in Nursing, and I have been a nurse ever since. And I lived in Houston up until my son started getting in trouble. So my daughter lived with me, and we did fine. We were living in Deer Park, Texas, which was right kind of like it was part of Houston, but it was a neighborhood called Deer Park, kind of by Pasadena and the Chemical Row up there. And when my daughter went off to college, my son was still with Cinnamon, but he was kind of big and he was kind of in trouble and he started getting into more and more serious trouble down in Houston. So in 2013, I just told Cinnamon, I need to take him. And we moved up to Fort Worth and we actually moved in with my mom for a while. But then I lived in Fort Worth and got a job with the VA in 2013. You know, as part of the move. And then I lived in Fort Worth until Turi moved to go to UNT and stay in the dorms, I transferred to Portland, Oregon, to work in the VA there.
Portlandia. Yes. What was that like?
The beautiful thing about the VA is because there's, you know, it's huge. So there's places everywhere, Hawaii, Europe, mm-hmm. Portland, Alaska. And I had always been real fascinated with Portland. And then, of course, you know, I started watching Portlandia and I got even more fascinated. But I transferred to Portland and I ended up settling in Vancouver, Washington, which is just across the river from Portland. And I was there for 4 years and I liked it a lot. Problem was, is like, you know, 2019, when COVID hit, my son came to move in with me. And then everything was just weird for like 2 years. And so I started missing my family, you know, because it was like, it was two solid years that, you know, nobody saw each other. But I moved back to San Antonio because my hope was that, you know, Ava and Terry would both, you know, come live with me and we get a house and all that. But man, Texas is just fucking weird and it's so hot. And I only lasted a year in San Antonio. And, you know, the kids were, they were old enough that they're doing their own thing. You know, my son is going to be 25 and Ava will be 29 next year. And they're doing their own thing. So, you know, they kind of reality set in that they're not looking to move in with their dad just because he's a little lonely. So I gave Texas a year. I lived in San Antonio for a year. And then I just moved to Colorado Springs once again, transferred from VA to VA. And I got to Colorado Springs October. And so this month I've been here a year and I'm going to settle down here. I'm sick of moving and it's just so pretty here. You wow. know, it's a little expensive, but it's not like Austin expensive. It's a little less expensive than Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
Yeah. But housing is, I was joking with friends that I'm going to start one of those dating profiles and it's just going to be, we can learn to love each other. Let's buy a motherfucking house. And it'll be one picture of me. And then there's going to be like 20 Zillow things of houses I'm interested in. but yeah, I think, yeah, Colorado Springs, I like a lot. And I think this is where I want to settle down. I know this is where I want to settle down. You know, I got a job lined up. It's the right size city. I'm right at the foot of Pikes Peak in the mountains. I love having four seasons. Like right now is like prime leaf tourism because mm-hmm. all the aspens, the leaves are turning and then all the pines are, you know, beside them. And so just it's just gorgeous. It really is pretty.
You mentioned at the end of your talk there that you're at a place in life where you would settle down. What is the ideal situation for you to settle down?
I'm easygoing. I just want to find, I see me with a nurse or a social worker that's easygoing. I have a nest egg. I have a pretty good job, federal job with good job security. My only two things right now is I'm fat as hell and I'm uncomfortable on my body. So I'm working on that. And I have two very ill-behaved cats that I had no idea they were ill-behaved. I just thought they were, you know, cats. I've never been a cat person, but, you know, during COVID, I got lonely. So I adopted a rescue cat and then I got another one before I moved up here. And they're just beasts. You know, they tear up your leather. They walk on the counters. So I got to find somebody that is understanding about ill-behaved cats and is easygoing and wants to buy a house with me.
All right, let's put that out into the universe, just like you yeah. picking that pigeon up and letting it fly right, out.
Right. So I'm a man with ill-behaved cats, but I have some stuff going for me, so that's what I'm going to put out there in the universe.
All right. Well, cool. Well, thank you, guys. I'm going to stop it here, but let's do this again soon.
Okay, great talking to you both.
Likewise. I had fun. Have a nice right. evening.
Someone Else's Memories by Revolution Void and Calm the Fuck Down by Broke for Free are used under a Creative Commons Attribution License.